The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The people who were thinking about the internet in the 1990s and the people who had the power, those who were calling for it to be heavily regulated and those who were saying hands off, they had something in common. And that is the fact that primarily we're talking about mostly white men who were thinking about the internet either as the worst thing that was going to happen to the world or maybe the best thing that was going to happen to the world. But there wasn't much attention being paid to, let's say, for instance, the experience of women or minorities online and whether or not they were having or they were likely to share in the supposedly transformative, radically democratic project of the internet. So I think there was just a lot of non-thinking going on in the 1990s. It wasn't that people were caught completely by surprise by how the internet took off, as it were, but there was just not a lot of concern or not as much concern as there should have been about things like harassment and about things like discrimination online. That was really not what people were thinking about, at least the people who had the power at the time.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 26th, 2021. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 immunizes platforms for the behavior of their users. It's been called by some the Magna Carta of the internet. But how foundational is it? Marianne Franks, professor of law and Dean's Distinguished Scholar at the University of Miami, thinks that Section 230 is indeed a cornerstone of the modern internet, but not in a good way. As part of Lawfare's ongoing Digital Social Contract research paper series, she recently published a paper entitled Section 230 and the Anti-Social Contract, in which she argues that, far from expanding freedom, Section 230 has simply continued a long tradition of marginalizing the most vulnerable among us. I spoke to her about her paper, about how Section 230 fits into the broader history of American political thought, and about her ideas for a better internet. It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 26th. Marianne Franks on Section 230. Marianne, for those of our listeners who might be unfamiliar with Section 230, can you start by explaining what it is and what it does?
Sure, and it should be such an easy answer, but it's actually kind of complicated. The really short version is that it's the law, the federal law, that essentially says that online intermediaries, things like Facebook and Google, are not responsible, largely speaking, for the kinds of content that users post on those platforms or the kinds of things that people do with their services. And there's a few more nuances to that, and some exceptions and some complications, but that's essentially what it does.
And when you say responsible, what we're really talking about here is legal responsibility. So things like defamation and that sort of thing.
Exactly. So what Section 230 does is it says that, you know, we can imagine that there's a lot of ways in which you could hold a lot of different parties accountable for certain types of unlawful acts, whether that's criminal acts or whether that's some tortious conduct of some kind. And what Section 230 is really narrows the kinds of liability, legally speaking, that online intermediaries would have for exactly things like you mentioned, defamation or harassment or a host of other things that people can get up to online.
And just to be clear, when we're talking about, again, things like defamation or harassment, Section 230 doesn't say that if Facebook defames you or if Facebook harasses you, then they're immune. It's that if a Facebook user defames another Facebook user, even if Facebook knew that and could control that, Facebook's just not liable for the actions of one of its users.
That's right. I mean, there are a lot of things you could imagine that an intermediary itself might be responsible for. If Mark Zuckerberg decides to start going after somebody on his platform, then of course Mark Zuckerberg can be sued. But to the extent that Facebook or Google or Twitter is being used by third parties, and those third parties are engaging in certain types of behavior, there are a really limited number of scenarios in which those platforms can be held accountable for that kind of activity.
And so why did Congress do this? What was Congress trying to accomplish here? And what role did the courts play in the interpretations of Section 230 that led us to the liability system we have today?
There's a lot of different stories about, you know, what happened in 1996 when Section 230 was passed. And there's a standard kind of narrative about what Congress was trying to do. And that standard narrative goes something like, the internet's new. We don't really know where this is headed. There's all this potential for it to become this, or has already become this incredible sort of way for people to communicate in ways that we couldn't before. And we don't want to stifle the innovation and the creativity and the possibilities of this. And so what you have going on in the sponsors' minds is, let's try to figure out a way for these platforms and services to control some of the bad stuff that's going to be inevitably part of their platforms, but also not have too heavy of a hand in regulating them. And so we want to sort of carve out the space for them to self-regulate, in essence. And that's the very standard story of what was going on in Congress's mind, a collective mind in 1996, which may or may not be the right story, may or may not be the accurate story, but is one version of what happened. And then there's a very complicated story about where courts went with that law after that, because Section 230, as anyone who's ever looked at the text probably knows, is not exactly clear on its face, right? There's a lot of terms in it that are not obvious, and there's a lot of ways that you could interpret what the statute it was actually intended to do or should be doing. But what many courts have done, the vast majority of courts have done, has been to read Section 230 extremely broadly and really interpret it in the way that means that effectively these platforms and services just don't have to take much in the form of responsibility for what goes on their platforms and services.
Now, you said that it's not entirely clear when you talked about the traditional story of why Congress passed 230, that story may not be accurate. And I'm curious what you mean by that and whether you think that there's a more accurate story to be told.
I think there's a more complicated story to be told, that what we assume a lot of the time is that the sponsors of Section 230 were doing this very careful thing, because the longer story about Section 230 is that it was sort of tucked away in this much broader attempt to regulate the internet. There was a lot of sort of porn panic going on in the 1990s. Congress was really worried about access to sexually explicit materials, especially access that minors would have. And that this, you know, this little 230 was meant to be, okay, let's not overreact to this problem. Let's acknowledge that there are some dark things out there, but let's, you know, make sure that we're not going to have this really heavy-handed approach in making these companies and these new entities responsible for everything. So that's one version of the story. I think another version of this is that the people who were thinking about the internet in the 1990s and the people who had the power, those who were calling for it to be heavily regulated and those who were saying hands off, they had something in common. And that is the fact that primarily we're talking about mostly white men who were thinking about the internet either as the worst thing that was going to happen to the world or maybe the best thing that was going to happen to the world. But there wasn't much attention being paid to, let's say, for instance, the experience of women or minorities online and whether or not they were having or they were likely to share in the supposedly transformative, radically democratic project of the internet. So I think there was just a lot of non-thinking going on in the 1990s. It wasn't that people were caught completely by surprise by how the internet took off, as it were, but there was just not a lot of concern, or not as much concern as there should have been, about things like harassment and about things like discrimination online. That was really not what people were thinking about, at least the people who had the power at the time.
So that's a nice segue into the main thesis of your paper, which is that Section 230 is you call this an anti-social contract. So before we get into why it's anti-social, can you just describe what you mean by it being a social contract of any kind, right? So what is this idea of the social contract? What role has it played in American political thought? I know that's a very broad question. In particular, what role does it play in how Americans have thought about the internet and internet governance generally?
So the social contract is such a fascinating concept. And anybody who has spent time thinking about politics or thinking about just, you know, history generally will know about this concept, that the idea is, you know, hundreds of years old. The social contract is kind of how we get civilization, that, you know, there's, of course, different versions of it and there's different ways to tell the story, but it's some kind of accounting for how it is that many people can live together without basically killing each other. And how that happens essentially requires some kind of trade-off between the individual's power, that is, the ways that we could all act aggressively in our self-interest, and the ways that we would pull back on that, or we would restrict ourselves, control ourselves for the sake of the common good. That if we all went around just thinking about our own self-interest and, you know, killing everybody who stole our acorns, right, we would never get to civilization. So we have to make this trade-off. And the way that we see this play out in American history, for instance, is that in the Declaration of Independence, you've got references to it, that there's this common welfare idea that we, of course, want to protect people's individual rights, but at the same time, we also have to think about the collective impact of power. We have to legitimize power. We have to have some way of saying there's a government here who's supposed to take care of the people on a very fundamental level, and that every individual, while having a kind of natural right to defend themselves and take what is theirs, is going to give up some of that power to this government so that we can have order, so that it's not every person for themselves. And so I think that is very fundamental to the way that American democracy conceives of itself, that this is, you know, this is why we put so much pride in the concept of the Constitution, that it's this notion that we've made a pact with society, that we are going to agree to restrain ourselves to some degree and let the government step in certain places, but also that the government should respect the individual's right to determine many things for him or herself. And so that's the, you know, kind of the classic concept of the social contract, which gets a very interesting sort of re-upping, I guess you could say, in the concept of the internet.
Yeah, and so let's turn to that. You connect Section 230 to a very famous document in internet history, this the so-called Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, which was written by John Perry Barlow, who was a former, who had been a songwriter for the Grateful Dead, but then became a kind of internet civil liberties pioneer. And he wrote this declaration in 1996 in response to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which was the law in which Section 230 made its way in. So what was this declaration, and what's the connection that you make, and why do you make the connection between someone like Barlow and a figure like Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, wrote the original Declaration of Independence?
Right. So on the first part of this is that you've got Barlow self-consciously sort of emulating the style, right? You've got the title of the document, which is the Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. So there it is, right? It's very much meant to be an explicit invocation of the Declaration of Independence. And while you have a kind of poetic reference to the social contract, you know, because Jefferson was a better writer, what you've got in Barlow is coming out and saying, hey, we've got a new social contract here, but it's the social contract of rejecting government, right? So he says, where there are real conflicts, where there are wrongs, we will identify them and address them by our means. We are forming our own social contract, right? So what he's announcing in the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace is such an interesting contrast to what Jefferson was announcing in the Declaration of Independence, even as he's sort of directly trying to mimic that style. Jefferson is trying to say, we have this new government that is this new social contract, and it's about all those concepts we just talked about before, the kind of respect for individual rights, but also making sure that it's a mutuality, a kind of mutual pledge to one another. And you've got Barlow saying, the conflict here is between the government and cyberspace. That is, the new frontier of cyberspace needs no government. The social contract is not between a governmental entity and the people on the other hand. It's just the people by themselves. There is no government. There should be no government. The only way that we can have the utopia that we really want out of cyberspace, which is how Barlow saw it, is if the government stays out. So it's a very weird invocation of the social contract, because it isn't about justifying government's power or about the idea of mutuality and respect in that sense. It's about saying government stays out and then we're going to get paradise.
So then let me ask, why do you then call it a social contract? And obviously some of this is just sort of semantics and what we choose to label different conceptions of a political organization. But you know, given that, as you point out, most social contracts in history, whether it's Jefferson's or Locke's or Hobbes's or probably all the way back to antiquity, I mean, these are all meant to justify government action. Whereas for Barlow, you have this kind of libertarian, if not almost anarchic conception. Why do you conceptually or analytically find it useful to draw a line between what in some sense seem like actually opposite conceptions rather than the same thing?
Right. So this is what gets at the heart of the kind of hidden story of the social contract. So what Barlow was doing, and I think that there's actually a lot of, whether he knew it or not, there was a lot of significance to the fact that he styles his declaration after the Declaration of Independence and uses the term social contract, even though, just as you say, on its face, it just seems like he's using the concept wrong. He's just doing it wrong. I think he's inadvertently put his finger on something, which is that the social contract is an illusion, and it is a made up story to try to tell oppressed people and vulnerable people and marginalized people that, you know, what's actually happening is for their benefit, right? The social contract has a lot of wonderful rhetoric behind it, no matter who we're sort of ascribing it to. Just take Jefferson, for example, the idea that there's a social contract when he writes this in 1776. What social contract existed between slaves and the state? What kind of social contract exists for women? So what you have is this kind of myth of the social contract, this invocation of a false idea. And then how is that similar to what Barlow's doing? It's similar in effect. That is, it has the same kind of sort of narcotic effect. It's that, oh, this is something that is going to be for everyone's benefit. We're going to get to democracy and we're going to get to happiness and order through this thing called the social contract. And when Jefferson says it, he's saying, that's why government makes sense. When Barlow says it, he says, that's why government needs to pull back. But really the one story that's being told here that's the same is powerful men, powerful people get to continue doing whatever it is that's going to make sure that their interests are served first and foremost. So you can call it whatever we like, or we can say government come in or government get out. The most powerful thing here is not about the legitimization of power. It's about the fact that power will always continue the way that it has been. The people who have power, the people who are white, the people who are wealthy, the people who are male will continue to get the things that they want to get. And this is going to be the story we're going to tell ourselves about why that's okay.
So I think this then allows us to turn to your critiques of sort of Section 230 itself. And I think it's pretty fair to say that you have a quite critical view of the kind of dominant ideology of 230. And so what groups in particular do you feel have been hurt by 230, and in what ways?
I think we can say that the people who have been really harmed by the interpretation of Section 230 that is dominant today include women and racial minorities and religious minorities. But truly it includes anybody who's ever been harmed in a kind of irreparable way by someone who used the benefits or the gifts of technology, right? Because Section 230 so severely restricts the avenues for justice for those people. And it just so happens, right? And it's not a coincidence, but it happens that the primary targets of that kind of abuse and that kind of injury, those people are going to be disproportionately marginalized communities, including women and minorities. And so those are the groups that I think suffer the most under the current regime that we have under Section 230.
Now, this may not be apparent to readers who are unfamiliar with your past work, but it feels to me that there's a very strong continuity between the argument you make in this paper and the argument you made in your book that came out in 2019, The Cult of the Constitution, which is a great book, and I highly recommend folks read it. It's super thought-provoking and admirably clear and direct in a way that books about constitutional theory often are not. And in that book, and I'm probably oversummarizing it, or rather I'm oversimplifying it, you basically argue that we systematically overprotect certain constitutional rights, and in particular you focus on the First and Second Amendments, and that we overprotect these rights in ways that harm the most marginalized among us. And that sounds just very, very much like the argument you're making here, except that instead of the Constitution, we've done this by statute. But a statute that has attained an almost kind of quasi-constitutional status, at least among those who think about, you know, the internet and internet governance. And so is that a fair characterization of the continuity with previous work? I mean, to put it another way, do you think that there is a cult of Section 230, just as there is a cult of the Constitution? And if so, why is it so cultish, right? One can like something, one can support it without the sort of genuflecting that we sometimes see with whether it's the Constitution or something like Section 230. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Yes, I think there is, you know, I even say in my book, as you mentioned, the book really focuses on certain constitutional rights that are overprotected, and then the certain groups whose rights within those spheres are highly protected. So it's the First Amendment and the Second Amendment that I focus on there. But in the last part of the book, I also talk about what I refer to as the cult of the internet, not necessarily the cult of Section 230, but the cult of the internet. And I point out there that a huge part of the cultish adulation around the internet itself is this kind of updating of the First Amendment for the digital age, right? That when you read people who are theorists of cyber law, if you read people who are Section 230 advocates, they talk about Section 230 in ways that are almost interchangeable with the First Amendment. And sometimes we'll even just come out and say that Section 230 is the internet's First Amendment. It's as important as it, maybe it's even more important. It is the sort of free speech protecting principle that exists in the internet space. And so when I identify that in the book, it is to show that that is an extension, that there is it's similar in so many ways, but not least because of that kind of pseudo-revolutionary moment, right? That we get our fetishization of the founding fathers and the Constitution and the First and Second Amendments because we idealize this moment of so-called revolution, which turns out to not really be a revolution in any kind of absolute sense. It turns out to be a revolution for slightly less privileged, wealthy white men to liberate themselves from the clutches of more privileged, wealthy white men, but not so much for everyone else. And then the internet revolution kind of does the same thing. It is basically saying, hey, things are so hard for us, you know, us poor people who are being oppressed, I guess, offline. And so we need this new cyberspace realm to really express ourselves because we haven't been able to do it before now. And the government just has to stay away from it. That's another kind of pseudo-revolution. And the fundamentalist kind of reading of that is the one that denies, as I say in the book and try to emphasize in this new piece as well, you know, denies the principles of mutuality and reciprocity that would actually be fundamental to a healthy view of the Constitution or of our collective participation in cyberspace or the internet. And that's what I think, that's where everything goes off the rails. Rights are great, free speech is great, but you can't just want it for your own tribe, which is effectively what we get when we transfer our First Amendment attachments to the digital realm.
But why is it that we get it for our own tribe? I mean, Section 230 is on its face quite neutral. It doesn't by itself apply to only white men or only to the most privileged or only to the most powerful. Why do you think that those who are traditionally marginalized or locked out of society in some ways, why can't they benefit from Section 230?
Well, you know, truth to be told, they can, right? Because the world is a varied place, and it's certainly possible and is true enough that there are ways for laws that sound neutral to benefit everyone, right? That there's a way that we can tell a story about how Section 230, read a certain way, benefits minorities and benefits women too. I'm speaking more to the sort of structural level that I see this happening, where I see this happening, not that we can't find incidents of it benefiting people from all kinds of aspects of society. But why is it, you know, that it's always going to gravitate towards the most powerful? It's because when you have a system whose deck is stacked so much for a certain group of people, neutral principles are going to maintain that status quo. They're not neutral at all. They are an affirmative commitment to the status quo. And if the status quo has been, it's never been equal, there's never been equality, there's never been a true distribution of opportunities or benefits or any of the privileges or rights that we think of that are important. If that's never been true, every time we get a law, whether it's a statute or an interpretation of an amendment that says, hey, everything hold where it is, that's just going to perpetuate that. So what looks like neutrality is a commitment to a very unjust status quo.
One of the things that's always struck me as quite notable about this debate over Section 230 is that many of its strongest defenders have actually been the very same traditionally marginalized groups on whose behalf you're making the argument against Section 230. And I just want to explore that because it strikes me that to zoom out from your argument, you're really talking about an argument almost about ideological hegemony of a certain kind of neutrality, right? And when you get into those arguments, you end up with the issue of false consciousness to explain why individuals whose interests are not aligned with the dominant ideology nevertheless might still defend it. So to make this more concrete and to give some examples within Section 230 itself, right? In 2018, Congress enacted a law that's come to be known as SESTA or FOSTA, depending on which acronym you choose. And basically it limits Section 230 in cases where the conduct at issue promotes sex trafficking or facilitates sex trafficking. And these laws, though, of course, enacted on behalf of victims of sex trafficking, they've been quite heavily criticized by sex workers and their advocates themselves, often frequently marginalized groups, right? And the idea here being that after Sesta and Fosta, companies who are very afraid of liability don't just crack down on sex trafficking on their platforms. They crack down on anything related to sex and sex work and transactional sex. And then more recently, the head of the National Black Justice Coalition, which is a Black LGBT rights group, he argued that Section 230 reform, however well-intentioned, will disproportionately harm the LGBT community, which again, relies on being able to communicate on platforms without censorship. So I guess my question is, I guess I have two questions here. So the first is, I mean, are you worried that attempts to reform Section 230 will backfire specifically in terms of harming the very communities that reform is supposed to help? And then the second question is more generally, you know, how do you think about this issue of false consciousness and or whether you would characterize it as such? You know, why is it that if Section 230 is structurally so damaging to certain groups, you still have lots of members of those groups defend it? You know, what is the mechanism by which that is happening?
Well, I think on the first point, I mean, to your first question about am I concerned that attempts to reform Section 230 will have unintended consequences, the answer is yes. And just because I think that Section 230 should be amended does not mean that I think that the myriad ways in which people have made proposals to amend it, that I think that they're good. I think a lot of them are very harmful. I don't think Sesta Fosta was particularly a good idea. So I do think that, you know, when we're talking about reform, we have to talk about the right kind of reform. There's absolutely a lot to be said for, you know, for rushing into this. And rushing actually is not the right word, because it's not as though we haven't known what the problems of Section 230 have been for a really long time. But of course, we want the right kind of reform. We don't just want any reform. And so, yes, there is a real problem that the devil that you know might in fact be better than whatever might come after. So I appreciate that concern. What it says to me, though, is, well, let's make sure that we get the right kind of reform. But surely we can dream a little bigger than what Section 230 has left us with. And so it is not that I would dismiss specific instances or objections to, hey, if you do X to Section 230, bad things will happen. Depending on what that X is, I might agree with that, which is why I am pretty specific about the kinds of changes I think Section 230 should, the kinds of changes that I think are wisest, not get rid of it completely, not, you know, roll back everything that has been done in the name of Section 230. But I also really think that, you know, whether we call it false consciousness or not, I think it's important to understand that most of us have status quo bias, right? We're as long as we're not at this very moment being oppressed overtly or exploited by something, we all have a tendency to think this is probably better than whatever could come next. And this is why it's so important, I think, as an epistemological matter, that you ask the people who are suffering the most under the status quo what they think would be better. People who are doing okay are going to want the status quo to continue because we're scared of change. But, you know, that we're back to this question of if we actually took a social contract seriously, which, you know, the American principle of government never has done, but is aspirationally out there, we really do have to ask that question, right? Who is the most vulnerable? Who are the people who are being exploited? And are we really going to say that the conditions we have right now with our current interpretation of Section 230 is the best we could possibly do? And I just simply think that the answer to that cannot be yes. Not if we actually listen to the people whose lives have been ruined, whose livelihoods have been taken away, whose speech has been silenced, whose ability to express themselves has been severely curtailed, whose voices we have lost, whose civic participation has been lost. And that's what I think we have to focus on.
So what then do you think is the alternative to 230 as it currently stands, whether it's replacing it with something else or reforming it? You know, as you said, you have some specific proposals, and I'm actually really curious what those specific interventions would be. You know, if you could rewrite the law or change the digital interpretation, where would you start, let's say?
Well, I would start, you know, as a matter of framing, I would say what we need to rethink, or actually maybe it's better to say what we need to stop thinking is we need to stop thinking of the tech industry as a separate industry, as a completely distinct kind of industry. What I mean by that is when people start to talk about Section 230 and the internet and about the changes that would happen if you took away some of this liability shield, they're having conversations that honestly we've had over time over many different kinds of industries, right? Think about all the objections to making cars safer, right? There were very few automobile companies that were really embracing the idea of seatbelts and airbags because they're expensive and they change things. And they mean that some smaller auto companies may not be able to enter the market because it's going to be so much more expensive to make every car. But that's a conversation about, okay, so you're saying that there's going to be a difficulty in changing your approach to your product, but it's one that's actually going to keep people alive. Okay. Or think about the big tobacco conversation, right? How long has that been the conversation of, yeah, we don't want to admit this or talk about the harm here because it'd be really expensive and people like cigarettes, you know? So we need to make sure that we're not looking at the tech industry and having those same kinds of naive arguments, right? About how, oh no, if they're responsible in some ways, or if these big players have to do something to think about not just their profit line, but also about the welfare of their users. You know, we can't just sort of react to that and say, well, we can't possibly require that of the industry. Of course we can. That is something that we do for every industry, with the possible exception of the firearms industry. So I would just say what we really need is not to treat the tech industry as, we're not trying to reform it in a sense, we're trying to bring it up to speed with every other industry in some ways. And what that really means is, do not grant them exceptionalism that other industries would not get. And even, and I say that even making exceptions for the fact, as many people want to say, well, the internet's not like cars and it's not like tobacco, it's speech. And that's actually where I would start the reforms. I'd say that one of the reasons why we're in the mess that we're in and why people get so confused about Section 230 and so defensive about the internet is that people really do think it's speech. They think that everything that happens online is in some way speech and therefore has to have constitutional significance, and that any tinkering with it means censorship and oppression. And I think the reason why we've gotten to that kind of distorted view of things is because Section 230 itself does not specify that the protections that intermediaries get are for speech. It says things like information and content, and it shouldn't. It should say, if we think this is about speech, let's make sure that they have this really wide liability shield when it comes to speech of others, that they won't be held accountable for defamatory speech by a user on Facebook, for instance. Let's make that really clear. And make it really clear that it may not apply to things like facilitating illegal firearm sales or putting defective products in the stream of commerce. Let's make sure that we're not giving it more of a wide berth than it deserves. So I think that's where I'd start. Make sure that it is changed statutorily to reflect the fact that the liability shield only applies to the speech of third parties. And make sure that we also make it so that you don't get this liability shield if you are an intermediary that is fully knowledgeable about what is going on illegally or unlawfully on your platform, and you could intervene against it and it wouldn't cost you that much, and you refuse to do so over and over and over again. At that point, I'd say they don't get that liability shield at all.
There aren't a lot of issues in DC today in which there's a lot of bipartisan support, and yet reforming or limiting Section 230 is one of these things that, oddly, I wouldn't say unites Democrats and Republicans, but it is a thing you hear from both sides. Though, of course, the conservative or Republican case for limiting Section 230 is very different from yours. And so I'm curious, you know, how do your critiques of Section 230 differ from those of, say, a Donald Trump or a Josh Hawley, you know, two politicians that have been very vocal in their criticism on Section 230? And do you think there's any space for bipartisan reform of 230, or are the sides just coming at it from such different perspectives that this is just going to become yet another political football in our ongoing political national nightmare?
Well, the bipartisanship on this issue has been alarming in many ways, as I guess maybe that's just where we live nowadays, that we should get really nervous every time we see Republicans and Democrats agreeing on something. But another way of saying it is that they don't actually agree on this, right? That as you've already indicated, the reforms or the changes or the repeal that you see the conservatives wanting are completely different from what most Democrats and others are concerned about. They're concerned about different parts of Section 230, and it really makes all the difference. It is absolutely baffling to me that anyone should take seriously a Trump or Hawley position on Section 230, because it so completely gets the First Amendment backwards, it gets 230 backwards, it gets everything wrong. And I don't just mean that as a matter of opinion, I mean as a matter of doctrine and fact, they just get everything wrong. On Trump's part, it's probably because he literally doesn't understand any of it. On someone like Hawley's part, it's cynicism, right? He knows better. He knows that you couldn't do what he's asking for, which is effectively to let the government dictate what a platform can and can't do, right? You've got people who are trying to say, hey, if I want to spew white supremacist content, you can't stop me, right? That's ridiculous, especially if you've got a government official who wants to make you do that. That's essentially a government official wanting Twitter to become his private propaganda channel. So that has nothing to do with the people who are engaged in actual concerns for the harms that are perpetrated online. And so I think it's actually really unfortunate that we even want to call that bipartisan, you know, appeals for reform, because they're really not coming from the same place. But, you know, to be, I guess, fair, there are some conservatives, some Republicans who are wanting reform on the parts of Section 230 that some Democrats want to. But I guess I just want to, you know, sort of split off that whole category of people who want to take away not really Section 230's protections, but the First Amendment's protections, because the piece of Section 230 they take aim at is actually a redundant piece, by which I mean Section 230 says that you have basically the right not to be sued if you take down material, because if you find it to be offensive or illegal or what have you, you as an intermediary have the right to take a bunch of stuff down. That is great that that's in Section 230, but it's also what the First Amendment already effectively says, because Facebook and Twitter and Google and all the rest of them, they're private companies, they're private entities, which means they have the right to refuse to carry speech. They have their own powers of not speaking and not being compelled to speak. So it's totally fine that that's in Section 230, but that's not why they have this power. So anybody who wants to say, I want to hack away at that part of Section 230 is really saying, I want to declare war on the First Amendment. And I think that is not even a legitimate starting point. I think we should just, you know, shunt all that off and say that doesn't count as actual serious Section 230 reform. But that leaves us with a lot of things to disagree about, which is the other part of it, which is what can we say about companies, not in terms of forcing them to keep stuff up, but what do we say about companies who refuse to take things down? And not only refuse to take things down, but will pocket the profits from not taking them down, right? So that you've got, you know, coordinated online harassment campaigns on a social media platform. And not only does the platform do nothing, they're actually taking money from it, right? Because they get more clicks, more eyeballs, more ad dollars. That's a problem. At least that's what I would suggest is the real heart of the problem.
Marianne, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks for writing this wonderful paper for the series. I urge all of our listeners to read it. It has the benefits of being short and wonderfully clear, two things that are often not the case with either legal theory or policy analysis. And so thanks so much. Thanks so much for speaking.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you've liked what you've heard, please take a moment to rate the podcast or let someone know so they can enjoy it as well. This podcast is produced by Jen Patya-Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.